Major funding for the following edition of Soundings comes from the School of Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the North Carolina Center for the Advancement of Teaching, and the University of North Carolina. Additional funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center, conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
When I was in graduate school, my mentor said to me once that there are two things you have to do in graduate school. One is to get a PhD, and the other is to get an education. And the two don't necessarily have much to do with each other.
And on the high school level, sometimes getting a diploma and getting an education don't have much to do with each other either.
Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. What should teachers know? Amidst the national dialogue about the direction of American education, Soundings invited six successful teachers to reflect on how they prepare themselves in spirit and intellect. This week, you'll hear from two of them. The topic at hand is the teaching of English and American literature. You'll hear from Matilda Balsley of Reidsville Senior High School in Reidsville, North Carolina, and from Andrew H. DelBanco, a professor of English at Columbia University. Here is Tilda Balsley.
Well, I think you have to remember as a high school teacher where the students are coming from. At 15 and 16, their interests are with driver's licenses and current movies. And so what I try to do when I teach them literature that may be about a time that is long ago, seems very distant to them, I try to relate it to their personal experiences right then. You know, this is like the bully that you might see in the hall, or this is, you know, this person is kind of like your parents, what they're saying. You know, I relate it to their personal experiences.
Do you have this kind of a problem, Andy? I take it that in a way you do, in a way you don't.
Well, I'm fortunate in that most of the students I teach are in my class because they want to be. I don't teach courses that they're required to take by the university. On the other hand, I think fundamentally I do have the same challenge as Tilda. These are students who've been driven partly by themselves, by their parents, by others who've had an influence on them in their lives to think in terms of their career, their vocation, where they're going. And it's important that we not lose sight, I think, that those precious 3 or 4 years in college are the last opportunity that many of these kids are going to have to sit alone with a great book and be forced to think about questions that they won't have time or inclination for later on.
Tilda, is there some sort of plan that you take in with you? Does it happen spontaneously? Describe this for me.
Well, you're supposed to have a plan. You're supposed to have a written down plan in the public school system, and so we do, but I find that my plans often go astray. I mean, I think a good teacher responds to how the class is responding.
Does it depend on the students, on the class, and does it depend on the material? Andy, let me hear you on that.
Well, my plan, I guess, is to try to do justice to the books we've decided we're going to read together that semester, and through them to do justice to the students.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do before I go into the classroom is to try to make sure that I myself am in a frame of mind through which I can communicate intensely my engagement with the work that we're talking about that
mm-hmm.
day,
mm-hmm.
which means reading it.
Right, and knowing it. Well, here again, right. What should teachers know? Tilda, give me a specific example of the kind of thing that you teach and how you make it appealing to your students.
Well, right now we're studying Julius Caesar, so I could start with that because it's very much on my mind. When I'm teaching a piece of literature, I usually read it again, which means that through the years you've read some of these things an awfully lot. I try to let them hear the language aloud. I try to let them grapple with meaning on a very minute level, you know, take these couple of lines and really investigate them. And I try to have them experience the acting it out, the drama of it.
Do you think of yourself as a scholar of Shakespeare? Do you think of yourself as an intermediary, an actor yourself in taking this to your students? How about that?
Sometimes an actor, yes. I think a teacher is, especially on the high school level, has to be kind of an entertainer.
Suppose you have a student who comes to you and says, "Ms. Balsley, I hate this stuff. Why do I have to read this junk? Don't make me do it." What do you say?
I hope you're going to change your mind.
Uh-huh.
I hope you're going to really, really like this by the time we get through. And I usually add, most of my students do. I try to convince them with my experience with other students that, hey, you know, that you may really change your mind by the time we're through with this, because this can be fun.
Andy, I take it that you believe in knowledge for its own sake. Do you think your students have an attitude like that? Do you think they ought to?
Well, as I say, the students whom I teach are not there by coercion, so they have at least a curiosity about what I'm going to be offering them. But I find there are still obstacles in their minds that need to be overcome, barriers that need to be broken down. For instance, when I teach what used to be called a survey course in American literature, I begin more or less at the beginning, that is, with the Puritan immigrants to New England in the 17th century. And it's the very rare student, even at Columbia where I teach, who has anything other than phony pictures in his or her head of what these people were about. I mean, they imagine people with high black hats and buckled shoes and going outside in the morning to burn the first witch they can find.
What is it? People who wear tall hats and take long trips?
Yeah.
those are Puritans.
Right, right, exactly. And have no fun while they're doing any of those things. So my challenge at the outset is to persuade these students that, in fact, these were living, breathing, feeling human beings whom we can still be in contact with because they happen to write something about their experience down. And they wrote it in an idiom, in a language that's very strange to us, because this is a world that was saturated with religious belief, that had attitudes about hierarchies, both within families and within states and cultures generally, that we no longer are quite so sure about. So there are many ways in which the students are resistant and indeed angry, even aggressively so, about much of what these people insisted upon. So my job, the way I think about it at the beginning of this course, is not to encourage the judgment based on ignorance, which is the first inclination, but rather to encourage the imaginative effort that's necessary to try to get inside the mind of someone who lived 300 years ago.
Let me respond to something he's saying. I like that idea of getting to know, you know, the people in their times, to know what it was influencing them, and also how they're like people right now. I think that's part of what the study of literature is understanding what it is to be a person in this time, in that time, what, you know, in this place, in that place. That's to me is what the students ought to begin to feel, to be interested in or to be excited about, is that they recognize this person.
Uh-huh.
You know, they recognize that, hey, that's somebody,
yeah,
I know.
Tilda Balsley, when you go in and teach world literature, do you think of yourself as transmitting facts? Do you think of yourself as transmitting values?
Well, I think the values are always a part of the study of literature, because as you, because values are they're intrinsic to the piece of work, to the author's, you know, view of what he was writing about. The,
mm-hmm.
the theme of something always has to do with values. That needs to be sometimes pointed out to the students, and sometimes they understand it sort of innately. But
well, again, when you prepare yourself as a teacher, are you aware? Are you deliberate in that kind of an approach? Or
pretty deliberate?
Do you walk in and say, "Now wait a minute, I've got to be real careful with the way these kids are going to react to my talk about a particular"? It doesn't have to be a doctrinal kind of thing, but what may be called religion or philosophy, that sort of stuff.
I am aware that that teachers can come under criticism for the way they present mm-hmm. controversial type values, but I usually take that risk because it's the only way to make it meaningful to the students. And a lot of times, if you feel that there would be families represented there by their children who would disagree with the values that I have in my life, mm-hmm. I present it as a question. And, you know, what you're really trying to do is stimulate their serious consideration of these issues. Mm-hmm. And so questioning, open-ended questioning, is appropriate many times.
Andy Del Banco?
Well, the students whom I teach, the university makes every effort to ensure that they are as diverse as we can possibly have them be. They are a self-selected group in the sense that they've achieved a certain academic proficiency. And maybe that distinguishes them from the students one finds in the public high schools in this country, who, alas, sometimes haven't achieved that proficiency. But the questions that are really either on their minds or just below the surface in their minds, I think, are very much the same. And those are questions that have always been pressing in American culture. That is, what common culture do we all possess? In what sense are we Americans? What have I got to do with this kid of a different color from the inner city if I'm a farm kid from Iowa? And we have both, and I have both in my classes. Now, the great advantage and luxury that I have in teaching these kinds of students, and in particular teaching them American literary works, is that my conviction is, and I try to communicate this to them, my conviction is that these have been the issues on the minds of our writers all along. I don't teach these works as oracles, as dispensers of wisdom. I don't foster the illusion that by the time you've closed the Scarlet Letter, it will have all come clear to you as to who you are, what it means to be an American. But I do think that it gives the student an opportunity to engage in that conversation, as it were, with a very intelligent mind from the past.
Andy Del Banco and Tilda Bosley, one of the reasons that I invited you both to participate on this series, What Should Teachers Know, is because you are both good teachers. Why do you teach the way you teach?
Well,
Andy?
I think the most honest answer I could give is that I teach the way I teach because some of the more important experiences in my life took place under the influence of great teachers, of whom I've been fortunate to have had a couple. And what I mean by important experiences, I guess I ought to say, is, what I mean is something like having the mind shaken, having the conceptions that we carry about with us about the cluster of values with which we surround ourselves and by which we define ourselves challenged very radically. Sometimes you can repulse the challenge and say, I still believe what I believed when I walked into this classroom, regardless of what Mr. Melville has to say.
Right.
Sometimes one can find that at the end of a reading experience, if it's a true reading experience, one can feel deprived of the foundation upon which one used to stand.
Mm-hmm.
In either case, it's something that ought to happen to you in your life, particularly when you're young.
Do you think this has happened to you, Tilda Bosley? I mean, here again, you come from a relatively small town in North Carolina, where there would be, apart from some of the racial differences, not tensions, but differences, don't you have pretty much a uniform kind of thing? Isn't it going to upset the parents for you to come in and try to shake these kids up and make them think things that maybe the parents don't want them to think about?
If I could shake them up that much, I'd be pleased. For the most part, high school kids are hard to shake up because they don't, maybe they haven't reached the point where they're realizing the seriousness of the questions that are being raised. In other words, that's always my effort to challenge them, to shake them up mm-hmm. somewhat, and they resist that. Just as Andy was saying, mm-hmm. he finds sometimes some resistance. You know, I still believe what I came into this course believing.
Sure.
That's pretty much what my kids, where they're coming from.
I was recently teaching Walden. And Walden is, in some respects, when you first encounter it, a rather
a pacifying, a tranquil, pastoral book, right? I mean, we think of it as a book about how to escape from the hurly-burly and come to terms with oneself in the woods. I don't teach it that way, but that can happen. Anyway, at the end of our discussion of Walden, I noticed that one of my students was very upset. And she was, I'd gotten to know her a little bit, so I knew something about her background. She is the daughter of a family of recent Asian immigrants. And she's very bright, and clearly under a good deal of pressure from her family to make it professionally in one way or another in this adopted culture of hers. And so she, and I was very pleased that she was willing to do this. She articulated what she was upset about. And what she said was that this guy, Thoreau, made her really angry because he made her feel uneasy about the things that she liked. And she, I mean, she used the word things with the emphasis on things.
Commodities, products.
You know, and she was very charming about it. She said, look, I like my clothes. I like my stereo. You know, I like my apartment to look attractive. Yeah. And why should I feel guilty? Disabuse myself of all of these things in order to get at my essential self the way he says? And Who the hell is he?
And what did you say to this?
Well, I mean, what I said about it was 3.5 hours worth of talk about about Thoreau. I mean, in that sense, you know, when you come to a moment like that in the classroom, mm-hmm. I wonder how Tilda feels about it. You're tempted to move completely into the pastoral role, which is always very close, I think, for the committed teacher, and to say, now, look, let's really talk about your life. And I refrain from that because I don't think it's my place to do that. On the other hand, I was very pleased that the text we had been reading, and I think she had been reading it well, had gotten her in the guts.
That's right. That would be my reaction, is I would be excited that she was approaching it with such honesty.
Uh-huh.
And you just, in the high school classroom, and probably even in the college classroom, it's a rare moment when the student has really met the work that has let it touch their lives in that way. And that's what you want. You want the literature to mean something in their own lives, for them to really look at the way it is rather than superficially saying, well, yes, wouldn't that be nice to go off in the woods and, you know.
Let me ask you to reflect on the following, Tilda Balsley, Andy Delbanco. How do you criticize yourselves as teachers? Is this a self-reflexive activity? You go home after you've taught and you say, well, I blew it, or I succeeded today. How do good teachers talk to themselves about their teaching, Tilda?
Well, rather than, I sometimes use formal evaluations. I have my students evaluate me, but really, for me, the effective way to see how well I'm doing is not with any kind of testing or formal evaluation, but just watching the students' reactions. Body language and facial expressions tell me whether they're really interacting with what I'm saying and what we're reading and what we're doing. And when I see a majority of the class slipping away, I realize it's time to try something else. And as we said earlier, different techniques at different times, you know, work for different groups of students. But I'm just always watching them for that kind of interaction, because unlike in the college setting, they're not there by choice. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit more of an effort involved to get them to interact. They're sometimes reluctant.
Andy, did you ever take an education course? I mean, how do you talk to yourself about being a teacher?
The only education courses I ever took were ones where I was sitting on the other side of the desk from a teacher who was trying to get me to think.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, you know, there's a big movement in our colleges and universities toward teacher evaluation as well. I'm not a big fan of that. My own sense is that if you're serious about what you're doing, you know it when you've taught a phony class. When you've blown it, you know it, because first of all, students can vote with their feet, and because you can see the glazed eyes. And if the day rolls around where you are willing to let that happen and you don't go home feeling awful, then you know it's time to go on sabbatical or hang it up.
There's a certain self-correcting mechanism in a real teacher that because I mean, we all know the rewards are not primarily financial. The rewards are primarily the experience itself.
And yet the temptation, to paraphrase here from Mrs. Cheney, who runs the National Endowment for the Humanities, is that you become institutionalized. You become part of what she pulls a phrase from William James, you become part of a tyrannical machine. And you do it because it's a way to make a living and not necessarily because of anything that's good that's happening between you and your students. Tilda, tell me about this. Is that too negative a view of teaching, teachers?
Well, when Andy uses the expression real teacher, that catches my attention because I think a real teacher is it's something internal. It's something that you are. It's a part of your identity. And it can be influenced by the workings of this tyrannical machine. It can be, but I don't think it can really touch what happens in the classroom.
Do you think the universities are doing a good job of preparing our teachers? I'm not talking about the schools of education. I'm talking about this question, what should teachers know in the sense of your preparation in spirit and intellect for taking facts and values into the classroom? Andy?
Well, there's an ironic situation at the moment in our universities. I would say that there's a certain kind of Reaganism that has infiltrated the culture of universities, and the universities have, for the first time, in effect, accepted the workings of the free market fully on one level, by which I mean they're now competing for well-known and well-regarded scholars and teachers, which means inviting them with all kinds of incentives that include, strangely enough, abatements from teaching.
Hmm.
At the same time, many of those who are profiting from this situation are very ferocious critics of the free market idea. So that on the rare occasions that they walk into the classroom, most of what they have to say is about how awful the free market is and the culture that it has produced. This is a strange situation from which our students, I think, are not particularly profiting, if I may use that term. I think universities right now have to do some very, very hard thinking about how to go about creating their faculties of the future.
Do you think, Tilda, that Americans expect too much of our educational system today? I mean, after all, you're in at one level, particularly people like you, Tilda, you're raising these kids. You're not just teaching them.
Well,
am I exaggerating?
No, you're not exaggerating, but no, they're not expecting too much. We really have to do a better job of educating our citizens.
Mm-hmm.
It's essential to democracy.
Andy?
Absolutely, and you can see in our universities right now a very, very painful debate going on. It's not even a debate because it's so amorphous and people are going off in so many different directions. And that is the discussion of what it is we should know, what it is we have in common, which is another version of the old American question of who are we.
Mm-hmm.
And if the universities don't find a way to foster a productive conversation along those lines rather than a destructive one, which it often seems to be today, then I think we're really in very big trouble.
I think it's important for a teacher to acknowledge to her students that he or she does not know everything. I think that's one of the most important things that the students learn, is that there is not a body of knowledge of which I am the master and you are going to learn it to that level too. That learning is a growing process, and that it goes in a lot of different directions at one time, and it's involved with interaction with people, and the teacher needs to be a well-educated person, but in particular needs to be continuing to be educated, continuing to search, continuing to question his or herself, and in that way she or he conveys to the students just what it is to continue to become educated.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not, I think, that too many students, maybe too much of the public, thinks that an education is something you attain and you've got it. And the teacher above all should be beyond that kind of limited thinking and that excitement for learning. I love to teach a novel. Last year, one of my students said they wanted to read more of a particular artist, and so I said, well, let me find, and of course this was the limitations of budget, I said, let me go to our book room and see which book of his we happen to have multiple copies of. That was what it, you know, boiled down to. And so I found Cat's Cradle. They wanted to read Kurt Vonnegut because I had told them that he was controversial and they loved that. And I'd never read it. But so I said, you know, I've never read this novel either. We'll read it together. They loved that because they knew that I was confident enough with the idea that learning didn't have to be something I already had, that I could grapple with this novel at the same time they did. And that was one of the best experiences we had because they had chosen what they wanted to do, and they saw me willing to take some risks. And that's
Andy?
Well, you know, a teacher of mine used to make a distinction that I think is exactly what Tilda's talking about here. He used to make the distinction between education and instruction. There's a minimal amount of instruction that I feel has to go on in my classroom. I mean, I don't even bother with dates and biographies. My students are motivated enough to find those things out, and they come up in the context of our discussion. Education is an entirely different matter, and education only happens when the person standing in the front of the classroom has engaged him or herself at that moment in the process of learning again. If my students know that I'm reading the text as if for the first time, and in the middle of reading a passage out loud, I might see something that I've never seen before and write it down in my notebook and not rely on last year's notebook, then they know that something's going on that's worth paying attention to. And that's the level of engagement that you have to rev yourself up to before you go into the classroom. If you don't, you're just going through the paces and it's a lost cause.
Andrew H. DelBanco teaches at Columbia University. Matilda Balsley teaches at Reidsville Senior High School in Reidsville, North Carolina. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with the first installment in a series of conversations entitled What Should Teachers Know? The preceding discussion is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 554. That's program number 554. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, conversations about commerce and culture. Henry Binford of Northwestern University will discuss his study of the invention of the slum in the United States. Thomas Richards of Harvard University will discuss his book, The Commodity Culture of Victorian England. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the School of Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the North Carolina Center for the Advancement of Teaching, and the University of North Carolina. Additional support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. What should teachers know this week on Soundings? This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Amidst the national controversy about the quality of American education, Soundings asks successful teachers how they prepare themselves in spirit and intellect. Matilda Balsley of Reidsville Senior High School in North Carolina and Andrew DelBanco of Columbia University talk about teaching English and American literature. What should teachers know? Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.